Our next case for argument is 23-1227 Platinum Optics Technology versus VIAVI Solutions. Mr. Summer, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Andrew Summer on behalf of Appellant Platinum Optics Technology, Inc. The Board erred when it determined that that PTOT had failed to show that a material that was notoriously easy to fabricate, easy to deposit, and had a wide range of optical properties could not be adjusted to have the optical properties of the claims. And that is specifically the index of refraction and the extinction coefficient of the material. I want to address three issues. There are a number of other issues in the brief, but I'd like to focus my argument time. First, on the motion to dismiss for lack of standing. Second, on the lack of evidence supporting the Board's finding of no expectation of success. And then third, on the Board's improper obviousness analysis that charted the specific working examples of the prior art into a graph and then said this is the tableau upon which we're going to determine the obviousness of these claims. First, standing. PTOT has been sued four times on the 369 or related patents in the United States and abroad. It was sued on different versions of filters that it had manufactured over the years and supplied into supply chains in Asia. We continue, according to the declaration that we submitted in connection with our opening brief, to work in that same supply chain with those same customers to improve filters that do the exact same thing. They're bandpass filters that are integrated into cameras.
For myself, the problem is there's one really important sentence in the declaration you submitted, and it is lacking in any kind of detail about what the in progress of development improved new generations of filters are to indicate that they will with a serious probability come within the claims as they've been asserted. It's very conclusory.
I agree that the nature of the filters described in that are conclusory. It says we're continuing to develop, but I don't think that you can look at that in isolation. I think you need to look at that against the backdrop of what has happened here and whether there is going to be an ongoing dispute regarding future filters that are designed to do the same thing in the same supply chain to the same suppliers. We have been told...
Right, but I mean, among the things that's not in that declaration is something that says our customers demand a particular functionality. That functionality essentially requires us to continue doing what we have been accused of doing for infringement. There's not necessarily a structure functionality correspondence without your asserting it and explaining it.
So, Your Honor, to answer that question, I agree that's not in the declaration, but we didn't think we needed it given the allegation from Viavi to our client that we cannot continue to supply under our supply agreements to these same customers filters, that the patent is not something we can design around to continue business. And that's at appendix page 4498, where it says, we expect PTO supply agreements with redacted customer require that PTOT has one of two duties, either to mitigate the circumstances or design around. And then it goes on to say, we don't think you can design around our patents. We think that that is enough to fill the gap that you've identified in the declaration with respect to the details on the product. Given that we continue to do activity with these exact same customers, we've been told there's no way to design around these patents, and that we anticipate releasing new versions of these for new products in this same supply chain to the same customer to serve the same purpose.
How does the dismissal with prejudice work, and does it reflect upon those particular items?
So that is a question in terms of how does the dismissal with prejudice work. So filter 25, which was in the second case, and then there were three different models. I can't remember all of them. 11246, I believe, was one of them. There would be a re judicata effect of that judgment. Now, as we know, re judicata is an affirmative defense, and something that if we get accused of selling a new version, we have to raise as an affirmative defense in our answer and then actually prove under this court's jurisprudence, two things. One is that it's the same patent or substantially the same allegation. But number two, that the product is substantially the same as the one that was litigated before. So forcing PTOT into a situation in which it is sued for the fifth time on these or related patents and then have to assert a defense of re judicata or issue preclusion based on a dismissal with prejudice seems to show that we actually do have an imminent potential dispute here over these new filters, which are expected to be released at the time of the declaration. It was 18 months, and it's been some time since then.
So I'm noticing on the Appendix 4498 page, the letter in which we don't think non-infringing alternatives are available is not specific to this patent. It says, based on the broad and varying scope of Viavi's U.S. patents claims, plural. We do not, plural with the patents as well as the claims, we do not believe the latter is possible. So that statement does not say we don't think you can design around whatever the patent is at issue here, the 369.
I agree that it does not specifically say the 369 in that sentence. I think if you read it in connection with all of the entirety of the letter and look at the allegations in each one of the complaints in which the 369 patent was asserted, that does show that they believe the 369 patent to be infringed by each generation or each different group of these filters.
But that's prior in time, though, to the dismissal, which includes the 369, correct?
Those two lawsuits, yes, Your Honor.
And the lawsuits as a whole were dismissed, or just the claims based on 369?
Just the claims based on the 369. There have been a number of litigation developments that I'm not entirely familiar with. I know there was a partial grant of summary judgment, some amended pleadings. I believe one of the two cases remains pending, and one has been fully dismissed. And I don't remember the procedural disposition, quite frankly, of that particular case, whether that was fully with prejudice. I believe it was out.
And the U.S. District Court claims were dismissed after a resolution in Taiwan or an Asian court licensing settlement, right?
So, yeah, before any of the U.S. litigations were brought, there were two suits, one in China and one in Taiwan.
Okay.
That resulted in a settlement agreement that had a date in it that says anything before this date, you're absolved. Anything after this date, you know, you're at risk. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. I haven't seen the agreement in quite some time.
You're at risk rather than you're licensed.
There is no forward-looking license. So that sets this case apart from cases like Apple.
Have we been told that?
Perhaps not. I can't recall a sentence in any of the briefing where we said there is no license. But I do think in distinguishing the Apple case, this would have come up. And the fact that we've had two complaints filed against us in the United States suggests that we are not licensed, including ongoing litigation for forward-looking acts that are alleged to be infringements.
Was there any document that went along with the dismissal as to the 369? I know we have the one-page document. It's notice of voluntary dismissal, but was there any type of agreement that was associated with that that explained what happened going forward?
No, there was not. There was, in the district court litigation, there was an argument. We sought a stay pending IPR. There were actually, at the time, three IPRs pending. Two did not get instituted. And in a footnote, Viavi had made a representation to the court that if the 369 does get instituted, we will withdraw it with prejudice from the case, and the court held it to its promise. So that's really how that particular dismissal came to play.
Do you want to move on to your no expectation of success argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So the prior art of record shows that the hydrogenated silicon material is easy to fabricate. It had a number of superlatives and a variety of different articles about this material, and one of the advantages of it was not only does it have a high refractive index, but it has a wide range of optical properties. And that's the Martin article that you can find in 26. I think this quote comes from 2675 of the appendix. But there are entire books written about this particular material. 3199 of the appendix is the cover page, and then following that are some other pages about hydrogenated amorphous silicon alloy deposition processes. This is an entire book. The board said there would be no expectation of success. And in the board's decision, the reason that it articulated for a lack of expectation of success was that Mr. Willie, our expert, who had 60 years of experience depositing thin films, he believed that it would take up to 100 experiments that could take months. And I think the board made a fact finding that it could take up to 6 months to do that. And under this court's decision in Pfizer v. Apotex, that is not enough to support a finding of no expectation of success. In fact, uniformly, the prior art shows that you can adjust the hydrogen content of this material to change its optical properties. Yes, both refractive index and extinction coefficient decrease. But that leads me to the second board error. If you look at each of the examples on the plot of Gibbons and say, well, they all generally behave the same. Here they are. They're all high extinction coefficient products or examples. And if you try to drop that, you're going to drop index of refraction. Well, that assumes that you're going to drop these points straight down. And that's not how this works. If you look at the patent, at column 5, lines 35 and 45, they discuss two of the figures. Extinction coefficient varies at what they call the band edge, where the curves start to go up faster, much more quickly than the extinction coefficient. In fact, if you look at the graphs that the board relied on, there's a very flat line that goes way out in past 1650, 1700 nanometers, and it remains above 3. It's not as, the index of refraction is not nearly as sensitive to changes in the extinction coefficient. So that's really not this impediment that the board found when it looked at this prior art and said, well, we're going to take these data points, and if you try to drop any of those down, you never know what you're going to get with the refractive index. I think a person of ordinary skill in the art, based on the record, would have realized that, yes, they need to do some experimentation. They may, and the board's finding, which we do not contest on appeal, is that you may have to do 100 experiments to come up with the material. It may take months. But that is not no expectation of success. And so with that, we think that the board's finding is not supported by substantial evidence that there would be no expectation of success. It never made the finding that there was no reasonable expectation of success because it found no success at all. It never engaged in, well, is this reasonable or unreasonable under these circumstances?
Well, I mean, isn't that what we should infer their finding actually was, that there's no reasonable expectation of success given that it will take up to 6 months and maybe 100 iterations? I mean, doesn't that translate into, therefore, we don't think it's reasonable? I mean, granted, they didn't say it that way, but how else would I interpret their...
Well, I think we're stuck with what they wrote. They said there would be no expectation of success, which was exactly the finding that this court reviewed in Pfizer v. Apotex and reversed.
Do you think I should understand their opinion to, when it says could take up to 6 months and maybe 100 different tests, to mean even after all that, there's no expectation of success? Or is that...
Sure. Like, because I think the law is such that in viewing obviousness, both motivation and reasonable expectation of success, you're asking what the person of ordinary skill in the art without the benefit of the invention would have known a priori. Would they have even charted this course? Is there something that tells them, I'm not going to be successful? And if you look at some of the cases that Viabius cited, like OSI, the in vivo tests were 99.5% ineffective. So would this have been a particularly good composition to put into humans? No. The prior art tells you you're not likely to succeed at doing this. In this case, we don't have that. We actually have the record showing.
I have to say, as I read the board opinion on this point, it felt more like they were making a determination on undue experimentation than it did they're making on a reasonable expectation of success.
Perhaps, and there is some language that alludes to enablement of the prior art, whether the combination is enablement in the opinion, but I think we both agree now that the board never really made an enablement finding. We felt we needed to appeal that because we didn't want to have somebody pointing to that and saying, well, they didn't appeal that issue and it's been waived and therefore you should affirm on it. But I think both parties now agree that whatever the board said on enablement is not really a finding. And with that, I will reserve my 4 seconds of rebuttal.
I'll restore your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Woodworth, please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd also like to start with the standing issue to explain why this court should actually dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction, and then we'll also move into the merits of the appeal should the court reach them, and explain why substantial evidence does support the board finding that PTOT did not meet its burden to show obviousness of the challenge 369 patent claims. So turning first to standing, and I think, Judge Toronto, you've hit a lot of the key points already. In order to have standing, it's PTOT's burden to show that they have a concrete and particularized injury, and they cannot do that and have not done that here. It's currently not an actual threat because of the dismissal that we've talked about with prejudice on the 369 patent. So all of their current products have no threat of infringement, nor do any products that are going to be essentially the same. That's what a dismissal with prejudice provides. So what they needed to show was that there is a future product that is imminent, that is not essentially the same as their current products, but for which there is a threat of infringement. And they have simply failed to do that.
When Mr. Sommer pointed to 4498, this document, is this prior to or after the dismissal? Is this the settlement agreement which resulted in the dismissal? How does this document relate to the dismissal?
This document was actually a warning letter that was sent in advance of the U.S. litigation. You can see that it starts by talking about what happened in the foreign litigations, and it talks about April 30th, 2020. So this is over 4 years ago. That was the date that Mr. Sommer alluded to in terms of after this date, any of your activity is not released. And so that's where the letter begins. It then says, we have understood that you are still continuing to practice these patents or our patents, and in fact that this is occurring in the United States. We therefore ask you to confirm if our understanding is incorrect or we're going to need to take legal action. So this letter happened before the U.S. cases were even filed, so certainly well before the dismissal with prejudice.
But after the dismissal, after the settlement of the Taiwan and Chinese litigation.
But after the settlement of the Asian litigations, that's correct.
So you had settlement of the Asian litigation, then you had the warning letter, then you had the settlement in the California cases. Is that correct?
It's not a settlement, but that's what initiated. After we did not receive a response to this warning letter, that's when we initiated the U.S. litigation.
And again, it's a dismissal as to the claim, but there is no other document that's associated with it?
That's correct. We did the dismissal with prejudice procedurally because the judge had granted a stay of the litigation pending any IPRs. He actually granted it before they were instituted. After two of the IPRs were not instituted and one was, we had agreed that in order to go forward and move forward with the U.S. litigation, that we would dismiss the 369 patent entirely with prejudice. And so on that record, again, there's no current threat of infringement, and they have not shown the specificity that's required under this court's precedent, and I would actually direct you to the JTECT case, or Apple v. Qualcomm, both of those. But JTECT in particular, the issue there was that the parties were competitors, the patent challenger was starting to develop products that they thought there would be a threat of infringement, but there was no final design of a future product. And because of that, how could the court assess whether there was a risk of infringement? This is what the court said. quote, no product is yet finalized. And therefore, we conclude that JTECT has not established that at this stage of the development, that its product creates a concrete and substantial risk of infringement or will likely lead to claims of infringement.
That is a very case-specific statement. It is made in the context of a scenario where they're saying, you don't have a product yet, so we can't determine whether there's a concrete injury. But what Mr. Sommer points to here is the 4498 language. I mean, a case can't stand for the proposition that when you're in the process of designing a product, but you haven't finished designing, you can never have a concrete injury. It just can't stand for that. That's what you're arguing. You're arguing it stands for this absolute, extremely broad proposition.
I think that there could have been more detail along the lines of what Judge Toronto was alluding to show that you have to have a concrete and particularized injury. You have to be able to show that that threat is imminent and that it's specific to the 369 patent.
Okay, I hear you, but the reason I'm pushing back is because I think you're asking for way too broad ruling on a legal issue that you probably don't even necessarily need to prevail, but I will not agree with. So I think you should pivot. But 4520, which is where the declaration is, says we are trying to develop additional bandpass filters that are going to fill this Asian supply chain, right? So there's particular functionality. There's a supply chain. We need to fill it. We're going to develop more filters to fill that supply chain. Then you have a letter, 4498. Now, suppose this letter, 4498, wasn't earlier in time, and suppose it was much later in time, and suppose instead of saying, based on the broad and varying scope of VIV's U.S. patent claims, which includes more than 369, we don't think you can sign around. Like, basically, if I were to read this letter as concluding that it's based only on the claims of the 369 and them saying, you can't fulfill the supply chain over here with anything that won't infringe our patent, I don't think they need a particular product at that point. I don't think they need a specific design. I think that they would satisfy the concrete injury because they're trying to fulfill a particular demand. I mean, with all due respect to all the parties, these filters are not that complicated.
That would be a much closer case. I agree with you. That there would be particularized evidence that would show that there's going to be a threat. But here, we don't have any of the details. They haven't told us what any of the materials are that they're working on. They haven't told us that it's going to be hydrogenated silicon, for example. Every one of the 369 patent claims requires hydrogenated silicon. It requires it to have two particular optical characteristics that the IPR is focused on in a particular wavelength range, 800 to 1100 nanometers, and it requires a very specific center wavelength shift. Those are the type of details that we would need PTOT to have supplied to say this is the type of product that we are aiming at, and we have absolutely none of that
here. Is it possible to have new models of the bandpass filters that will satisfy the existing customer demands that don't meet those criteria or characteristics?
To be honest, PTOT has non-infringement positions in the litigation, so certainly they believe that there are, and others have as well. Actually, the 369 patent has been enforced against PTOT, but we have had other U.S. litigation against competitors where it was not enforced because of the specifics of their filters. So I don't know if anybody has looked at whether or not it would meet the particular requirements, but certainly there have been competitors, there have been litigation that did not involve the 369 patent because of its claims, because they're different. That's exactly the point that we're getting at in our letter. They're varied, they're different among the portfolio. And so PTO, again, this is PTOT's burden and they have failed to meet it. Are there any further questions? Then I'll move on as well then. Substantial evidence does support the board's finding that PTOT did not meet its burden to establish obviousness based on the four-way combination of Pilgrim, Gibbons, Larison, and Yoda. Counsel began with the proposition of just how well-known the hydrogenated silicon material is. I believe it was notoriously easy to fabricate. He went through several articles, none of which are the IPR references, as well as a book to describe just how well-known this material is. But yet PTO concedes, as it must, there is not a single prior art reference that teaches hydrogenated silicon having the two claimed characteristics in Viavi's patent claim that's being challenged. Not a single one. Viavi was the first.
Across the full claimed range.
Exactly. The claim range is in the claim, and across that range, there's not a single reference that teaches that. But then moving on to obviousness, for the support, I would direct the court's attention to appendix pages 3862 to 3900. This is the declaration that Viavi submitted of its expert, Dr. Clemens, and he spends 38 pages walking through the references, explaining why they neither teach nor suggest the claim properties of hydrogenated silicon, why a person of ordinary skill in the art would not be motivated based on any of these teachings to arrive at the claimed invention, nor have a reasonable expectation of success that they would do so. Both Pilgrim and Gibbons, which are the two primary references the PTOT relies on, Mr. Summer talked about how none of the K value is not reached, the extinction coefficient. And he said, well, anyone would know, a person of ordinary skill in the art would know, all you need to do is adjust the H value or the hydrogen in there in order to reach the property for the K value. But he has to admit, and he has, that that negatively impacts the N value. It drives it down. And it's undisputed that both Pilgrim and Gibbons would direct a person of ordinary skill in the art to maintain that N value as high as possible. So there's no motivation, there's no reason to try and add hydrogen to drag down.
What did the board exactly find with regard to expectation of success?
I think it found several things. It obviously found, as I've already alluded to, that none of the references teach the combination of the two claimed characteristics. And it says over and over again, it relies on the fact that those are counterproductive. So getting one to the lower level that you want is going to increase or is going to decrease the other, and it might take it out of the claimed range. So that was a big part of their factual findings, which is acknowledged by their expert and acknowledged here by counsel on appeal. So I think that that's one of the most important factual findings that they made.
Where did they make that finding? Do you remember?
They refer to the word counterproductive. So appendix page 35 and 36. So at 34, they say the specific combination had not been achieved. They also say just before that, that at the time the inventors were working, that our two objectives.
On this specific point, if you look at the six lines on page 34, the beginning of the, at the time of the invention.
Right.
Right. Is that the point? The inventors were thus faced with a situation in which their objectives of relatively high refractive index, that's your N, and relatively low extinction coefficient, K, were in tension. And that's because the hydrogen works at cross purposes.
That's exactly right. And that's the point that I'm making, which they then said later on that page that no reference teaches that specific combination. They then, again, going on to 35 towards the bottom, explain how these are not, the N and K values are not just parameters to adjust. They're actually the resulting characteristics once you change parameters in the manufacturing process. And again, they say that those are counterproductive.
So what do you make of all of the testimony, which was, I think, the subject of some discussion by Mr. Summer about the amount of experimentation, and I don't mean anything technical by that word, but the amount of experimentation that would be required to find the sweet spot where the N and the K are both okay?
I think the experts were actually quite consistent here. PTOT's expert admitted, and this is at appendix 4117, This is with respect to the process that he was suggesting a person of ordinary skill in the art would follow. He says, there's a fair amount of guesswork in these initial stages as to what may or may not work. He also says, and this is at Appendix 4126, he agrees that there's not real predictability on the different sputtering processes as far as what refractive index and instinction coefficients that we'll get. And then specific to the two references that PTO...
Sorry, what's being varied in the various experiments?
What he says that you would vary is largely hydrogen, the hydrogen content, which would be the hydrogen flow rate. But PTOT has admitted...
So the amount of hydrogen is going to be in the plasma or something that the knocked-off particles are going to go through and pick up before they land on the substrate.
You got it. That's exactly right. But PTOT has admitted...
And does it disclose the specific amounts of hydrogen that would have what impact?
That's a great question, and absolutely not. That's one of the things that our experts said over and over again is completely lacking in these references. There's absolutely no teaching as to Gibbons and Larson as to how much hydrogen they use to even create their films. So our expert explained you can't even recreate their films, let alone know how to improve upon them. That's also at appendix pages 4117, where their expert acknowledged this. Gibbons does not say what energy level to use. Gibbons does not provide any guidance on the sputtering parameters. Gibbons does not provide guidance on what level of hydrogen to use. And in light of all this, at appendix 4126, their expert, Mr. Wiley, admits the Gibbons and Larson papers do not, quote, have enough detail to decide without experimentation what you might get. So this is not a simple...
That last thing isn't no reasonable expectation of success. I mean, don't you agree that a reasonable expectation of success can be satisfied despite the need for some experimentation?
Yes, and counsel relies on the Pfizer case, for example. And to turn to that, I think that case is a good example, but this case is just so very different from it. In Pfizer, the court acknowledged that the prior art did not only just disclose the compound, it disclosed specifically how you would make it. That's what's missing here. The parameters of how to do it, what to change, all of that was known and disclosed in the prior art. One other key point, the Pfizer court said, this is not a case where there are numerous parameters to try. But this case is. You have all these different levers. You've got the hydrogen. You've got the substrate temperature. You've got the flow rate. You have at least four. I can add to that the sputtering, whether you're sputtering or depositing. I mean, there's different ways of making this. There's many more than even four. But giving PTOT the four key ones that they've focused on, that's too many parameters. And not only that, again, the claimed invention is about two characteristics that will result from those parameters that are going to have differing impacts. While they both are going to go up for hydrogen, for example, we don't know how much. That's not provided in the prior art. But the claim says one of them needs to be up and one of them needs to be down. So how do we get there? We don't know. We don't have guidance. We're going to have to do at least 100 experiments. And then to get back to your question about success, Mr. Wiley, their expert, then said, even at the end of all that, you might not be in the right place and you might have to start all over. He admitted that the references do not provide the guidance that you need, that there is a lot of guesswork involved. None of the references that are in the IPR and none of the others that Mr. Sommer alluded to have ever achieved the claimed result before the inventors did.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Woodworth. Mr. Schumer, I'll restore your 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. So going back to a question that Judge Toronto asked when I was up here about where in the record is there some evidence of this license and its term, appendix page...
From the Asian litigation?
Yes, from the Asia litigation. In appendix 4502, there's reference to it in Viavi's complaint. I believe this is the second filed complaint on paragraph 11. Just to provide that for Your Honor, it's the last sentence of that paragraph. I want to touch on just one point on the standing issue, unless Your Honors have further questions based on Ms. Woodworth's presentation. But that is that there is a rationale for not asserting the 369 patent in some cases that are not of record. We are unaware of what that rationale is. She's saying it's because there are products out there that don't practice those claims, but as far as I know, it could have been because the patent was being challenged in IPR. So I don't know that there's any evidence in the record to support that conclusion.
I have a question about sure. any activities subsequent to the withdrawal or that dismissal of that claim. Has there been any letter writing campaign, anything that would approach a level of concern in terms of your adversary coming towards you and seeking to protect its patent? Or have things been silent? Because, of course, we're looking at the state of affairs.
So in terms of whether there's been allegations against these products under development,
yes.
there have not been.
Okay.
Because they're not in the market yet. I don't think that there's anything that they could plausibly
accuse. There's nothing in the record
accuse.
That indicates anything regarding that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Very well.
In terms of this argument that the person of ordinary skill in the art would have been kind of put out to sea and left to pick all of these different variables, and that there's a chance that even after 100 experiments, you might need to start over, reasonable expectation of success does not require an absolute possibility or expectation of success. It doesn't have to be absolute. So it's possible you may need to start over, but there's no finding about how likely that is or whether that's unreasonable under these particular circumstances. In terms of the parameters that are at issue, you know, giving us the four, I believe, was the comment that's just too many. This material was highly researched. At page 24 of our reply brief, we have a table summarizing kind of the key performance values used in the manufacturing process for hydrogenated silicon that the references generally gravitate toward and show that hydrogen content, deposition rate, gas pressure, and substrate temperature were known to be the key drivers. And everyone knew in the art, and all, I believe our references all unanimously show it's the hydrogen bonding that leads to the change of N and K. And these references talk about how you go about manipulating the hydrogen bonding and what types of parameters you use. Same thing with the textbook. Viavi's counsel points to Dr. Clemens' testimony, but you'll remember a passage from the board's decision that we challenged the admissibility of his testimony because he was given only the references that were the basis of the challenge. He didn't look beyond those references, and we know from this court's jurisprudence that reasonable expectation of success, like motivation to combine, doesn't need to be strictly found in the references. It can be found in the knowledge of a person of ordinary skill in the art. It can be found in other literature that's not the basis for the grounds in the IPR petition. And we submit that that's what the record shows here. So unless Your Honors have any questions.
Okay, I thank both counsel for their argument. Both counsel was incredibly well prepared and helps the court in understanding this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my clerks just texted me, this is the best oral argument I've seen since I've been here. Sorry for whoever comes next.
We can let them know we were well trained, Your Honor.